All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's SNEB webinar, The Power of Protein. I'm sponsored by the National Dairy Council. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of SNEB, and glad you're joining us for the presentation today. The slides for today are available as a handout. If you look in the GoToWebinar toolbar for the handout section, you can go ahead and download that. It might be helpful to follow along and make notes during the presentation. We did leave time for a question and answer at the end of the presentation, so please type any comments or questions you have in the question block, and we will moderate those to our presenters at the end of the session. If for some reason we have more questions than we have time for, we'll do a follow-up summary document and get that out to everyone. When I close the session today, there will be a short survey, and we really appreciate your feedback on this session as well as your ideas on future sessions. And then we are recording today, so watch for an email from me on Thursday of this week with the link to the recording, the handout, as well as the CEU certificate that you're earning with your attendance today. Now, I will turn this over to our moderator, Matthew Bukowski, to get us started.
Thanks, Rachel, and thanks to SNEB for continuing the partnership with National Dairy Council and sponsoring educational sessions such as these, which we hope your members find valuable. Oops. Sorry, just a little technical difficulties there. So again, my name is Matt Bukowski. I'll be serving as the moderator today, and I would like to welcome you all to the webinar on behalf of the National Dairy Council. I'll be helping out with the question and answers, but you know, the main stars of the show are really the two speakers that we have today. I'm really excited to welcome Dr. Nancy Rodriguez and Monica Reinagle. Dr. Rodriguez is a professor of nutritional sciences in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at the University of Connecticut, where she holds joint appointments in the departments of kinesiology and allied health sciences, and serves as a director of sport nutrition in the Department of Sports Medicine. Her current research program focuses on relationships among exercise, protein intake, and protein utilization in athletes, physically active adults, and children. Monica Reinagle is a board-certified licensed nutritionist and professionally trained chef. Her expert nutrition advice is regularly featured on the Today Show, CBS News, NPR's Morning Edition, and in many leading newspapers, magazines, and websites. She's the author of 6 books, creator of the weekly Nutrition Diva Health and Fitness podcast, and author of her blog, Nutrition Over Easy, where she features healthy eating tips, recipes, and other food and nutrition topics. In terms of the objectives for today's webinar, they are listed here. First, we want to provide an overview of the current basis for protein requirements and recommendations. Second, we'd like to review the role of protein's amino acid composition in impacting muscle mass and potentially physical function. Thirdly, we want to try to translate that science into practical tips for meal planning. And lastly, we want to be able to provide a framework for helping clients build healthy eating patterns that deliver on taste and incorporate high-quality proteins. Lastly, just a reminder that this webinar has been approved for 1 continuing education credit from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And just as an FYI, you're going to be receiving an email within about 2 days of this webinar with a link to be able to download that certificate. So thanks again for joining, and without further ado, I'd like to hand this over to Dr. Rodriguez. Nancy?
Hi there. I was on mute, so that was my mistake, and that's a little technical difficulty. Thank you, Matt, for the kind introduction. I also want to thank the National Dairy Council for having me as a participant in this webinar, and hello to everyone who is participating and listening to this afternoon's presentation. My presentation is going to focus on protein quality and quantity, some of the current existing research and how that can be translated into some practical recommendations for us as practitioners. I'd like to start off by sharing with you professional disclosures specific to funding for research that I've conducted over the years, as well as current speaking bureaus and advisory boards for which I serve. One of the things I would like to note for the audience is that, for the most part, these disclosures do reflect my sincere interest in the fact that if we approach nutrition in terms of whole foods and the meals that we feed, I think that there are opportunities for us to put these considerations in terms of protein quality and quantity into very reasonable and practical ways for people to eat. And that's going to be something that Monica will address more specifically once I've moved through my presentation. I plan to review for you some aspects of understanding protein requirements versus our evolution into recommendations in the context of health and wellness. That means we want to consider minimal protein requirements and some of our thinking in a traditional sense, and then move through what are optimal protein intakes with regards to aspects of health and wellness and active aging. The significance of protein quality is really the focus of my presentation today, and there are some points I'd like to highlight for you with regards to protein synthesis, ultimately muscle health, and what that might mean in terms of muscle quality and muscle function. When considering protein quality, we're going to think about the energy efficiency of the different meal plans and what that might mean. And ultimately, I'd like to present an interesting concept for you in the context of essential amino acid density, and then allow that to be a segue to Monica's creating healthy eating patterns that are considering some of this scientific evidence. As we all know, protein is fundamental to life. In contrast to carbohydrate or fat, it is the only macronutrient for which a recommended dietary allowance was established when the RDAs were first put into place in the 1940s. Those roles that protein plays, and one of the reasons it's unique, is the fact that it does contain nitrogen and these amino acids that then allow us to produce in our body a number of different proteins, a number of different tissues and carriers and hormones that are critical for good health. In addition to building, maintaining, and repairing muscle, we know that protein serves a role as a component of hemoglobin and myoglobin in the context of oxygen delivery. It's essential for us to have a good immune system. If necessary, it is an energy source. Some of the recent evidence that has come from researchers, Heather Levy is one that comes to mind, is the fact that protein in and of itself contributes to satiety and fullness in our meals. It's essential for neurotransmitters and for cognitive function. And as components of enzymes and coenzymes, protein is critical for metabolizing other nutrients. We know it's significant to building stronger bones, and for many of us in practice, we consider it as a macronutrient that's essential to diet design and weight management. That being said, when we look at the recommended dietary allowance for protein, we think about the fact that we have 20 or so amino acids that are needed to build these proteins for these roles that we highlighted in the previous slide, but we also need to consider that out of those 20, 22 amino acids or so, that really at certain points in our life cycle, as few as 8 or as many as 10 amino acids are considered essential or indispensable to the diet. And they are indispensable to our diet because we cannot make them in our bodies. Rather, they must be provided in the food that we eat and the foods that we consume. These essential amino acids, the branch chains in total, and leucine as a branch chain amino acid in particular, have been shown to be essential for stimulating and supporting muscle protein synthesis. Much of this work has evolved over recent years, and that's caused us to move from this traditional thinking of a minimal amount of protein to an optimal amount of protein. So I'd like to take a minute or so to remind you of that recommended dietary allowance, or that basic 0.8 grams per kilo body weight that has really been central to diet design from early on for many of us when we were initially earning our degrees and training to become clinical nutritionists and thinking about how we design our diets or what the diet prescriptions must obtain for us to be successful in managing our clients or in managing patients. And that RDA is really considered and is by definition the minimum amount of protein that should be considered to meet the nutrient requirements and classically prevent a deficiency in nearly all healthy individuals. That minimum amount is based on nitrogen balance, and that's a key consideration when you think about the methodology that's used in evaluating protein utilization, the effects of different levels of dietary protein intake on protein synthesis, whole body protein utilization in the context of health and wellness. And so as our research has evolved over recent years and different methodologies have become more precise in tracing or tracking how our bodies actually use dietary proteins, in 2005, the DRIs, the Dietary Reference Intake, really established an acceptable macronutrient distribution range for carbohydrate, fat, and protein. With regards to the latter, protein can actually contribute anywhere from 10 to 35% of the total calories. And that's a relative amount of calories specific to energy requirements or recommended energy intakes that we calculate or estimate for our patients and our clients. So the DRIs did give us a lot of flexibility as practitioners and how we can design diets and what considerations we might make for protein as a required nutrient. Most of us are pretty familiar with the fact that greater intakes from dietary protein are typically accepted and recommended for athletes and very active or even routinely active adults, as well as for older persons. But in the context of today's presentation, what I'd like to do is, you know, think about this quantity of protein and think about it in the context of not only the relative amount that's represented as a percentage of our energy intake, that 10 to 35% in the protein AMDR, but also in the context of what we might define as an absolute amount of protein, or for the RDA, that 0.8 grams per kilo, or a lower protein diet, and then for moderate or higher protein diets, anywhere from 1.2 to 1.8 grams per kilo. And that latter recommendation really falls within what we would see for athletes, active men and women, as well as for older adults. This particular panel highlights that for you, and it also gives you specific references that would allow you to look at evidence that's been provided so that we can be comfortable in considering protein intakes that are actually higher than the RDA, but are well within the acceptable macronutrient distribution ranges. This next slide not only highlights the information that was shown in that red panel with the respective references, but it also gets you to begin to think about where we're headed with today's webinar in the context of taking that absolute or total grams of protein that we might consider in a diet prescription or in a recommended diet design for a patient or for a client, in that we break it down per meal, and we also consider it relative to, in this case, that essential amino acid leucine, which has been shown to be important to initiate protein synthesis, but also in some instances, we could wrap our brain around that as being reflective of essential amino acid content of respective foods. I think that all of us, and certainly with our training, have been made aware in the clinical context that we need to be cognizant of the fact that protein intakes, higher amounts of nitrogen, might have to be considered with regards to kidney function. Today's webinar is focused on healthy men and women across, you know, our age range from young adults to older individuals, and also in those previous slides, some considerations for older individuals that might have clinically compromised situations or may even in some instances present with malnutrition. However, when these individuals are looked at in the context of renal function, healthy kidney function, I think it's important for us all to consider this recent publication, which talks about the fact that protein in diets where those intakes are higher than the RDA but represent some of these optimal benefits in terms of satiety, weight management, better glucose management, in terms of body composition with weight loss, and also perhaps in the context of bone health, that those amounts of protein that are associated with these cardiometabolic benefits really do not appear to have any apparent significance in compromising or impairing kidney function. So that for the context of today's presentation, we can move away from what in many instances we would consider to be a myth with regards to these higher protein intakes. Keeping in mind what we're talking about today in quantity is well within the ranges that are recommended in the AMDR. So let's switch gears for a minute and think about not just total amounts of protein, but begin to transition into what we want to consider with regards to protein quality. I don't think that this slide tells you as nutritionists anything new. It basically reminds me, hopefully reminds you, that when we're talking about complete protein, we're really considering in the context of proteins that provide all of the essential amino acids. Because when you historically look at a protein requirement, although the work is based on nitrogen balance, the impetus for much of that work was based on the fact that scientists such as Rose basically showed in animal models, and then eventually when we look at recommendations in terms of growth for infant formulas, that everything was based on essential amino acids. And getting all of those essential amino acids in because they are required for growth and for development. So when you're thinking about sensible diet design, lots of times what we lose sight of is the fact that we want to consider these higher quality proteins. And so in many ways, the fact that a requirement for protein is based on the requirement for essential amino acids has been lost in translation. So let's consider the fact that when you look at what we need to maximize protein synthesis and look at what goes on with regards to whole body protein utilization. This particular work that was done by Borsheim and colleagues at UTMB in Galveston basically shows that if you look at a mixed amino acid drink, and that's in the black bar, versus a mixed amino acid with carbohydrate, and those mixed amino acids are going to contain both essential and non-essential amino acids, but what's been held constant across the amino acids is that 6 grams of essential amino acids, is that you actually see that with the essential amino acid alone, that more deep gray bar, is that you get the highest response in terms of protein synthesis. And that adding carbohydrate to that, which might provide an insulin response with it, you still don't see any difference. So what's reinforcing in the context of protein requirements is that essential amino acids are critical, and that really it's the essential amino acids that we have to remember have to be included in our diet design, because they are indeed indispensable to the diet because we don't make them, but they're also critical in terms of maximizing a protein synthetic response. As a result, you start to think about, well, what is making so much of a difference? And this is a slide that you might have seen in other presentations by Dr. Stu Phillips, but I think that it makes the point that not only are essential amino acids critical, but that leucine can serve as a trigger. And if you move through, these are all good quality proteins, casein, soy, and whey, but when you actually look at the amount of leucine that results in the intracellular pool, which is the precursor for muscle protein synthesis, you can see that you have this improvement or enhanced muscle protein synthetic response subsequent to the availability of this essential amino acid leucine. So in the context of protein quality, we're just going to take a minute and look at a couple of these different studies. And the nice thing about the studies that you're going to be seeing is they actually cover a broad base of protein sources, but they do focus on high-quality protein. And I think that it's important for me to remind you that when you're starting to look at research that's been done in the last 5 years, up to a decade, that's looked at protein and protein quantity in terms of the protein synthetic response, in terms of weight loss or changes in body composition or glucose control, is that those have all been done with high-quality proteins. So we're somewhat remiss. There's not literature where you're looking at lower-quality proteins, because we've recognized the essentiality of good-quality proteins in the context of the amount of protein that we should be feeding. So in this particular study, or excuse me, in this particular slide, you see two panels of two different studies that were done in young adults between the ages of 20 to 24 years. And in the panel on the left, Moore and colleagues looked at an increase in protein intake from egg protein, and they basically showed sort of a plateau occurring at around 20 grams of protein as a total amount of protein consumed, which represents about 8.5 or around 9 grams of essential amino acids when you're using egg as the primary protein source. In the panel on the right, Wittard actually did a similar study. They looked more specifically at the myofibrillar protein, and they showed that, again, around 20 grams of protein in the exercise state really resulted in a topping off of the protein synthetic response. So in young adults, it looks like about 20 grams of protein is a good amount of protein to maximize protein synthesis for these individuals, and looking at high-quality protein sources. When you look at studies that have been done in older protein, in older adults, the amount of protein is increased somewhat because we know that there's an anabolic resistance and a somewhat delayed or less response in older individuals. But again, what becomes clear is that when you're looking at protein intake, and in these two studies, you're looking at the response to whey protein, right around 20 grams of protein and then going up to that 35 to 40 grams, you see an increase in protein synthesis and a benefit to consuming more protein in individuals that are up to 70 to 75 years of age. So when you go back and review the slides prior to this, these research studies, you'll find that these support those recommendations in that red panel and also in the slide that's subsequent to that. If you're going to move to looking at it in terms of healthy eating patterns, what I'd like to do now is use the last of my time to talk about protein distribution in terms of what we want to think about with this absolute amount of protein, anywhere from 20 grams in younger individuals up to 40 grams in older individuals, and consider the fact that we don't want to backload protein at an evening meal. And in this review that was done by Padden, Jones, and Rasmussen, they basically proposed that If you can maximize the protein synthetic response somewhere between 20 to 35 grams of protein, if you could distribute it over three meals versus looking at it in the context of how people often eat, and that is they backload their protein, is that the advantage to maximizing protein synthesis really occurs when you distribute it across three meals. I think it also allows us to see that if you don't maximize that protein synthetic response, you're somewhat at a disadvantage in terms of maintaining your muscle mass throughout the day and habitually over time. They followed this work with a very nice study that actually considered a 24-hour protein muscle synthetic response, and basically, without belaboring the point, if they divided up the protein over the course of the day, 30 grams per meal, and then this particular age was a little more middle-aged, around 40 years for the participants, what they showed in looking at protein synthesis on day one and then 7 days out is that when the protein was distributed throughout the day versus when the protein was skewed or backloaded into that evening meal, that there was an enhanced or a greater amount of protein synthesis that occurred and was sustained when you had this distribution of protein over the course of the day. And in this particular study, they were actually looking at beef protein in the context of the diets that they were designing. So we see a broad base of different protein sources, all of them being high-quality protein sources, providing the essential amino acids. And as I close, this is one of the thoughts I would like for you to consider as practitioners. We relatively consider calorie density, the fact that in this case you get, you know, 100 calories and only 8 chips of Doritos, but in 25 medium strawberries, the same amount of calories, but all of these other essential nutrients, phytochemicals, fiber, and things that are going to be beneficial. So we would certainly move through this context of density with regards to energy, no problem. With regards to nutrient density, we're very comfortable talking about how many nutrients you get for the calories or for the weight of the food. So I'm proposing that you consider essential amino acid density. Since we know that there are requirements based on essential amino acids, and we think about the fact that for specific databases, you can actually look at the essential amino acid content of specific food sources, then why not consider essential amino acid density in the context of diet design? So this particular slide takes certain foods, all of them that we would consider protein sources, and the calculations are described for you in the footnotes below, but it has you think about the fact that certain foods provide more or less of essential amino acids, even though we think about them routinely in the context of protein sources with regards to protein quantity. So with that thought in mind, what I'd like to do is wrap up and just remind you that RDA only sets a minimal, and it's based on nitrogen balance, not really on these functional outcomes that we consider in the context of health and well-being. And that as you start to look at more recent literature, it does support or provide the foundation for dietary protein intakes that are greater than or equal to 1 gram per kilo per day, with regard to these cardiometabolic and musculoskeletal benefits. Finally, there is good evidence to support distributing that protein throughout the day, anywhere from 20 to 40 grams from younger to older individuals, with a target of 10 to 15 grams per day, and that if you consider that for an individual that weighs anywhere from 70 to 80 kilos, we're talking again something that's in excess of the RDA, but very reasonable at 1.1 to 1.3 grams of protein per kilo per day. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Monica so she can talk to you more specifically about ways that you can put this into food. Thank you, Nancy, and thank you for that great and very thought-provoking presentation. Also, I'd like to thank the National Dairy Council and SNEB for hosting this webinar, which I think it really helps us take a novel and important look into how our approach to protein as clinicians is evolving. I just have a couple of disclosures to share with you. I do serve on the Whey Protein Advisory Panel, and I do some educational outreach for the American Dairy Association here in the Northeast where I live, mostly focused on sports nutrition. And we've just seen, I'm actually going to go back through the three main pillars of Dr. Rodriguez's presentation in terms of optimizing quantity, quality, and distribution. And as she said, try to translate this into the practical applications that we can use to help our clients and patients. We've seen now quite a bit of compelling research suggesting that protein intakes above the minimum requirement, that RDA of 0.8 grams per kilogram, can enhance function and well-being, particularly in athletes and in older adults. And there's other really good research that we didn't have time to review today showing that higher protein intakes during weight loss can also reduce the loss of lean muscle tissue during energy restriction. So there's a lot of people that can benefit here. But I'm trying to back this slide up. You may have heard that from various media sources that Americans are already getting more than enough protein in their diet. This was from an article just a couple of weeks ago in the Washington Post. And I've also seen people in the media suggesting that we're getting far too much protein and that this is somehow hurting our health. So let's just take a look at how much protein we are actually getting. This is current NPAINS data. And as you can see, across every different age category, from age 2 to those over 70, and in both men and women, the mean protein intake is right around 15%, between 14 and 16% of total calories. So it does show that most Americans, anyway, are consuming enough protein to prevent deficiency, but clearly, there is more than enough room to increase protein to maybe start to access some of those enhanced benefits and still be well within the recommended range of the AMDR between 10 and 35% of calories. Now, this shows the mean intakes for all different age groups. There may actually be one group that are more likely not to be meeting even those very low minimum requirements. Protein intake tends to decrease as we get older, and this is due to a variety of factors. People tend to eat less of everything. They have a reduced appetite. They're not as active. Frequently, older people are not cooking as much at home, and so they may not be preparing the same kinds of balanced meals, and often it comes down to just they may be having difficulty chewing, some dentition issues that means that they're not eating as much meat. But for a variety of reasons, protein intake declines with age, and you can see here is the daily value, which kind of hovers there between the RDAs for men and women, that as people get to 70 and beyond, their protein intake start to get pretty close to that minimum requirement, and in fact, about 5 to 10% of seniors are actually falling below the recommended daily allowance for protein. Now, the percentage of adults that older adults that may not be getting enough protein, it depends a little bit on which recommendation that you're basing it on. At the current minimal RDA level, we consider 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight, somewhere between 5 and 10% of our seniors are not getting the recommended daily intake. But if we consider these higher protein recommendations that Dr. Rodriguez has gone through for us and that researchers are now saying are consistent with successful aging, the percentage of seniors that are not hitting those recommended amounts may be substantially larger, up to maybe even half of them. It's also worth pointing out that while calorie needs decline with age, protein needs do not. So we need fewer calories as we get older. We're less active. Our metabolism slows down a little bit. But our protein needs don't go down. And if anything, what we're seeing is they may
increase. We may need a little bit more protein as we get older to really optimize our benefits from protein. And obviously, that means if our calorie needs are going down and our protein intakes are going up, that the percentage of calories that we need to be getting from protein in our diet is going to be larger as we get older. Now, if you're eating a variety of different calorie counts but trying to hold protein steady, the amount of protein by percentage of calories is obviously going to increase. So if you have a young college student who's eating 2,400 calories a day and they're getting that recommended 90 grams of protein per day, their protein intake is going to be about 15% of their total calories. But for somebody who's maybe 60 and they've decreased their calorie intake to try to maintain their weight, but they're trying to hold that protein intake steady as we suggest they might want to, then their percentage of calories from protein might go up to 18. And if you're working with somebody who's actually cutting calories perhaps to induce weight loss, but they're trying to keep their protein up at 1,600 calories, that same 190 grams of protein would be 23% of total calories from protein. But you can see that in all of these scenarios, we're still well below that upper threshold of 35% of calories from protein. And then just a very practical way of looking at this, if you're trying to cut calories without reducing protein, then what this means is instead of cutting your portion sizes across the board by a certain percent, just trying to eat, you know, 20% less of everything, you might want to consider leaving the portion sizes for your protein foods where they are and cutting portions of other less nutrient food groups like perhaps your starches. So instead of having a half a sandwich, you know, cutting that sandwich in half in order to cut calories, where you would have half the bread but also half of the filling, you might suggest to someone that they have an open-faced sandwich, so where you're cutting the calories from the bread but you're still maintaining the same amount of protein in that meal. And similarly, instead of having just a reduced portion of chips and Greek yogurt dip, you could hang on to that dip, which is a nice source of protein, and replace the chips with vegetables so that you're reducing calories without reducing protein. Now, I think we've also gotten seen some very good arguments for re-examining our assumptions regarding protein quality. In the most recent Dietary Guidelines for American, we saw a shift, a welcome shift, in trying to focus our rhetoric on healthy eating patterns instead of individual nutrients in an attempt to try to give consumers advice that's more useful and helpful to them. And in the Dietary Guidelines, they gave us three examples of healthy eating patterns, which were a variety of different approaches, the healthy U.S. style, a healthy vegetarian style diet, acknowledging that we have an increasing number of people who, if not completely vegetarian, are trying to eat vegetarian or plant-based meals more often, and also the healthy Mediterranean style diet. And you can see that in each of these dietary patterns, the number of servings of the different food groups has been tweaked a little bit up here, a little bit down there to get those all to fit together. And it really just shows that we can put together healthy diets in a variety of ways. But if we drill down a little bit into the protein food group, we can see that the recommendations here probably have the widest range of any of the other food groups, with the healthy vegetarian pattern recommending just 3.5 ounce equivalents of protein per day, almost half as much as is recommended in the healthy Mediterranean style diet. So that's a pretty big range. Now, for those protein foods, we're given some guidance about what is included there. And it includes both plant and animal sources, seafood, meats, poultry, and eggs, but also nuts, seeds, and legumes, including soy products. And we're also given some guidance on what that 1 ounce equivalent would look like. So 1 ounce of meat, poultry, or fish is said to be equivalent to one egg, or 1/4 of a cup of cooked beans, 1 tablespoon of peanut butter. Each of these is considered as a 1 ounce equivalent to the protein food group. But these protein equivalents are clearly not equivalent, either in terms of the amount of protein that they're providing or the quality of protein they're providing. Here are six of the items listed as protein foods in the 1 ounce equivalent, and you can see that the almonds, half an ounce of almonds is given as a 1 ounce protein equivalent, has about a third as much protein and only about a quarter as much of the essential amino acids that Dr. Rodriguez was talking about as tofu or chicken. So these protein equivalents are not at all equivalent. And if you recall back to the vegetarian diet pattern, they were only allotted half as many protein equivalents. And depending on what they're choosing, each one of those could be significantly lower in both protein and essential amino acids. Now, I'm not trying to imply that vegetarians can't get enough protein or they can't get good protein quality and quantity, but it clearly is going to take a little bit more guidance and, frankly, a little bit more work for them than it will for omnivores, and that's something that we need to be prepared to support them in. It's also interesting to note that foods from other groups that not outside of the protein group also provide a significant source of protein, and this is interesting. We have a couple of one food from the dairy group that actually provides more protein than one of the foods from the protein group. And similarly, the whole grain group can provide a significant amount of protein and is sometimes, you know, equivalent or better than some of the protein equivalents. As Dr. Rodriguez mentioned, we also want to take the calorie cost of protein into account when we are planning meals. And this slide is really to show how variable that can be. So we've lined up various protein sources and we've equalized them by the total amount of protein that they're providing. And we've also given you some information there about the amount of total essential amino acids as well as that key essential amino acid leucine. So this is how much of these different foods it takes to provide those 25 grams of protein. And you can see that the calorie cost is dramatically different. Up into our nuts and grains, we could be requiring 5 or 6 times as many calories as we would for our most efficient sources of protein. Again, it's just something that we need to keep in mind so that we can design meal plans that are optimizing protein but also appropriate in terms of energy. We've also talked about the unique contribution of leucine, in particular for triggering muscle protein synthesis. And here's another table that I think can be really helpful with meal planning for clients and patients because it shows a whole bunch of different protein sources, both vegetarian and animal, so plant-based and animal-based sources of protein in a typical serving size, with a guide to how many calories that provides and also how much protein, how much leucine, so that we can help to cobble things together that are going to get everybody in the target zone. You can see, again, the proteins from the animal sources are the most efficient in terms of delivering the most protein and the most leucine and essential amino acids for the fewest calories. And, you know, because dairy in particular are one of the best sources of leucine, our ovo-lacto-vegetarians are not going to have, an insurmountable challenge hitting these targets. As you can see, the vegans are going to have a bigger challenge because the legumes and grains and nuts and seeds that they are relying on are significantly less dense in terms of their essential amino acid density. And so they're probably going to need a little bit more support with their food selection and their meal planning in order to get that good protein quality in the context of a balanced and energy-appropriate diet. So here's just a sort of an illustration. This is a fairly typical meal that's organized around a piece of animal protein, a little grilled chicken, some rice, some greens. Looks like a healthy meal, and there's how it nets out at the bottom, 500 calories, plenty of protein, and we've hit both of our targets in terms of leucine and essential amino acids. And in general, when you have a meal that's organized around some animal protein, this, you know, falls into place rather easily. Meal option number two is a plant-based meal, which is organized around some portobello mushrooms. Again, this is also what we would normally consider to be a pretty healthy, balanced meal for a vegetarian option. We have some mashed potatoes, a nice salad with some cheese and some chickpeas for some legumes for some additional protein. It has the exact same amount of calories, but you can see it's got 30% less protein. It's got a lot less leucine. It's only got about half of the essential amino acids. And this, I think, is something that might have been a little invisible to us as practitioners when we've been trying to help people plan healthy meal plans. This is not always top of mind for us. If anything, we were looking at total protein and perhaps not focused on essential amino acid density. But again, this is not to say that our that it's not possible. Here is a third option in which I've taken the second one and just made a couple of little tweaks. I've replaced that the mashed potatoes with a half cup of cooked quinoa, which has a higher essential amino acid density. I subbed out some feta cheese instead of the cheddar cheese that was in the original, and I replaced the croutons, which were there to give a little crunch to the salad, with a couple of tablespoons of toasted soy nuts. And with those couple of little adjustments, I was able to increase the protein higher up above that 25-gram target. We got almost to 2 grams of leucine. We're almost at 10 grams of essential amino acids. We took some significant steps in the right direction, didn't add any calories. But again, this does take a little bit of extra attention, extra planning, and it's something that we need to get used to thinking about. And finally, we really do have a new paradigm in terms of protein distribution. We're all accustomed to thinking and talking about protein requirements on a per-day basis, but I think we really need to start thinking about setting targets on a per-meal basis so that we can optimize muscle protein synthesis and all of the different benefits that flow from that. And here we have some NHANES data again, and this is just showing how we typically eat protein at each meal during the day. And although the total protein intakes are in that target zone, at least for the guys, they may only be hitting that 30-gram threshold at which MPS is maximized once a day. So what I take from this is that if we were to distribute the same amount of protein more equally through the day, we could be getting a lot more benefit from the same amount of protein. And clearly our biggest opportunity here is at breakfast time, where the protein intakes are lowest. Typical American breakfasts, the so-called continental breakfast, tends to focus mostly on carbohydrate foods, cereal and toast and pastries and fruit juice, and tends to be fairly low in protein. I'll just point out this is not necessarily so in every culture around the world. Here are some examples of typical breakfasts from other places. We could borrow some ideas from our global neighbors and start thinking a little bit further outside the cereal box, but we can also tweak these more typical American breakfasts to be higher in protein. As you saw in a previous slide, whey protein powder is a very concentrated source of protein and leucine and relatively low in calories, and this slide shows how just adding a tablespoon or two of whey protein to these typical breakfast meals can really bump them up in terms of their protein quality and quantity. Whey protein powder, is a very useful tool in trying to enhance protein quality and quantity. I think of it as sort of a functional ingredient that we can use. It's very neutral in flavor. It's very pure. It doesn't have many calories in terms of fat or carbohydrates. You're really only adding protein. It's very low in fluid, so it's not adding a lot of volume or changing the texture of a recipe. It's shelf stable. And it can even be used to add sort of body and creaminess to fat-free or low-fat foods. And if you're looking for ways to incorporate whey protein into meal plans, I've got just a couple of tips having spent some time working with it. If you're adding it to a hot food such as oatmeal or cream of tomato soup or a sauce, you want to add it after you take the food off heat. Just stir it in at the last minute, because if you cook it for an extended period of time, you can get a little bit of curdling. I like to mix it into creamy dips, cold dips like a guacamole or ranch dressing, and then you can take something that really has no protein and turn it into a protein center of a snack. You can just add 2 tablespoons of whey protein concentrate to a regular cup of flour in any recipe, and it'll bump up the content, protein content and quality of baked goods. You can blend it into skim milk and get a creamier texture with no extra fat. And you can also blend it into nut or seed butters. You know, peanuts are actually a legume, so peanut butter is not a horrible source of protein, but the other nut butters, for people who may avoid peanuts, like almond or sunflower seed, much lower in protein, and we can help them along a little bit by blending some whey powder into them. I have found, though, that it's very difficult to do this with a wooden spoon. You really want to get at your stand mixer for this. This is an example of a recipe that I developed for the National Dairy Council, where I took sort of a savory bread pudding with eggs and milk and bread and some vegetables and a little bit of cheese, and was able to increase the protein 50% just by adding some whey protein powder to the egg and milk mixture. And that recipe is available on my website at nutritionovereasy.com, and there's a lot of other recipes along those lines available at the NationalDairyCouncil.org. I'm mindful of the fact that we're getting to the end of our time here, and I do want to leave time for questions. So I'll just quickly flip through these last few slides, which give you some other examples of lunches and dinners and snacks that have been developed to be higher in protein and specifically to enhance the protein quality and the essential amino acid density. And those will be available to you in your handouts afterwards if you want to review those. And moving into our takeaways for today, for both of our presentations, for me, the takeaways are that the current RDA really may be, we may be selling ourselves short, that we may be getting a lot of benefit from protein intakes above the current RDA, especially for these groups, seniors, athletes, and people engaged in weight loss, but that all protein sources are not at all equivalent as sources of essential amino acids, that we really want to think about protein on a per meal basis and not only be looking at what it's all adding up to over the day so that we're maximizing our benefit. And that means most frequently in the typical meal patterns to be looking for ways to optimize protein quality and quantity in breakfasts and also in snacks. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Matt to moderate any questions that may have come up.
Thanks, Monica, and thanks to you as well as Nancy for delivering, you know, what I really feel were excellent presentations. And hopefully the audience agrees and, you know, we're able to find a nice mixture of, you know, some quality scientific content as well as, you know, some ways to take that and translate that content into useful information that could be shared with our clients and patients. So, again, thanks to you both. I know we have a few minutes to address some questions. So the first question, and I'll direct this toward Nancy, just kind of wondering from one of the participants, why is the ANDR range set so large? It seems like that's such a wide range, that 10 to 35% of total calories. I'm wondering if you could comment a bit for that attendee on that question.
That's a good question, and, you know, I'm not, it is a very broad range. I think that if we were to look at it, when those ANDRs came into play, there was a lot of concern regarding too much protein, and that we could, excuse me, not too much protein in the diet, too much carbohydrates in the diet, particularly simple carbs, and that perpetual insulin elevation and the deposition of fat and perhaps the promotion of obesity versus trying to manage it. And with regards to dietary fat, folks were being a little bit more restricted, so that fat range also went up a little bit. I think that the ANDR for protein was put at the 10%, you have to be very cautious as a practitioner because that 10% range, depending on the calorie intake that's recommended for an individual, just barely gets to the RDA of 0.8 grams per kilo. So that's the low range, and I think that low range was actually set as a minimum. I think in terms of that high range, the 35%, that's looking at the different diet plans that can be recommended in the context of making trade-offs with carbohydrate and getting in protein such that you have a macronutrient composition of a diet that will accommodate many weight loss plans that have been successful in a variety of different clinical and public health settings with regards to managing weight. It's really speculation on my part as to why it goes that far, but I think that it really is in the context of allowing us flexibility to accommodate these higher amounts of protein that will be getting to appear beneficial to weight management, and also to accommodate the low end with regards to the minimal amount of the RDA. Matt, what would you?
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, it's kind of really giving some, I think the biggest thing to, I guess, complement is just really allowing practitioners a broad range from which to kind of tailor a unique diet prescription for an individual. So I think, you know, similarly when you look at dietary guidelines, AMDR, et cetera, you know, those recommendations are built as best as they can be to kind of hit broad population-based targets. And I think, you know, what we always kind of learn as practitioners is then, you know, taking that as general guidelines, but then really knowing who that unique person you're working with, what are their specific dietary goals, and then, you know, really these guidelines allowing the flexibility to do some tweaks that's going to work for the person, not only, you know, from a, I guess, scientific or, you know, practitioner standpoint, but also that's going to accommodate their taste preferences and meal preferences. So I think all those factors come into play.
And then, so we can get to the next question. I do want to make one other comment. For me, it's a positive that someone in the audience is actually asking about that broad range, because one of the things that's happened over the last decade is, as we've gone from our experiences in Protein Summit 1 to Protein Summit 2, is actually getting practitioners to acknowledge it is a very broad range and to realize they can take advantage of that in diet design and not always adhere to, these are the calories I need, and once I set protein at 0.8 grams per kilo, I'm all done. You can actually begin to look at these cardiometabolic, musculoskeletal benefits of protein, and then be creative with some of the diet designs that Monica presented.
Great. Yep. Thank you. Appreciate that feedback, Nancy. Next question for Monica. Just a general comment. One, you really were able to provide some great resources and really liked how you took the various food combinations and broke that down into either, you know, total protein, but then looking at the different amino acids. The question is really, you know, could you recommend some resources if these, you know, folks are looking to do that on their own and do some additional meal patterning and building and ways to identify, you know, what are the amino acid compositions of various foods? Could you provide some recommendations there?
There are a lot of resources that consumers use to do meal planning, you know, everything from, you know, MyFitnessPal, you know, where they can track and look up basic information like how much protein or how many calories are in a food. Unfortunately, those are not going to provide detail such as the individual amino acid breakdown of foods. For me, I mean, most of us have dietary analysis software that we use, but consumers aren't going to spend a few hundred dollars for that. I would send them to the USDA database, which is available online and searchable online, and is a very thorough and reputable source where they can look up foods and get that kind of detailed information. It's not as slick as some of the more commercial sites in terms of the ability to, you know, to create recipes and save things, but if they're just trying to, if they're really willing to drill down a little bit, that is a resource that they can tap, and there are tools on that. Matt, we can probably, it's a very long URL, too long to give out verbally, but we can make that available, can't we?
Yes, yeah, in some of the follow-ups, we can ensure folks to can get that. And I think just in general, because I use that quite a bit as well, if you just Google USDA Nutrient Food Database, it will come up as like the top kind of result in Google that you'll be able to access that. So that's
and they
great...
also have a tool that allows you to search by individual, search and sort by individual nutrients. So you don't have to just hunt and peck and look up foods one by one. You could actually search for foods that are high in leucine, for example, and come up with a list.
Great. Yeah, that's new to me too. So thanks for sharing that. Rachel, I want to be cognizant of time. I know we're right up at the 1 o'clock. Do you think we have time for one more question, or should we just kind of do some closing comments and we'll address the others in a follow-up email, as you mentioned?
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe one more question. We're fine.
Great. This question for Nancy. Nancy, there's interest in kind of, you know, that older adult, that could be fairly broad when you look at that as a general term. And, you know, this person was looking, might their recommendations be different for someone that's, you know, in their early to mid-70s versus someone that's 80-plus? Do, you know, we have any information on that in the research, or?
That's a good question. And in the context of research, per se, I think the information that's there is probably limited, because what we've done at different protein think tanks, and Nat, you've been involved in certain kinds of scenarios, is we've looked at folks as we get older, and we've begun to think about healthy aging, good quality muscle, good quality of life, and being able to function, and how that fits in to offset loss of muscle with aging, sarcopenia, and keep people active, versus another, I guess we could call it a subpopulation of older folks, 80 plus, that might be more frail. And I think that because we don't have a good maybe sample population of folks that are 80 plus that would fit into this, some of the studies that we've been looking at or work that we've been done, we don't have that kind of information. I would speculate that the recommendations at 70 to 75, you know, moving upwards to 85, 90, I don't know that they would be that much different, but that would only be my speculation based on what's there. But in terms of evidence, I think that what most of what you would find in the literature when you start to get up to 80 or 90 might be the work by Roger Fielding and colleagues and some others, where they're dealing more with frailty mm-hmm. in clinical scenarios versus what we're focusing on today, which is that component of healthy aging, looking at middle age, young old, and then I guess we would consider getting up to 75, 80, like old old.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I think we've gotten most of the questions covered, so I'll go ahead and wrap this up. Just a reminder that when we close out the session, there'll be a survey, and your responses are greatly appreciated. Watch for an email from me on Thursday of this week with a link to the recording, the slides. I think we've mentioned a couple maybe additional resources that I'll put in that follow-up handout, and then your CEU certificate that you earned for your attendance. And just a reminder of some upcoming SNEB webinars. On September 8th, the Higher Education Division is doing a webinar on virtual reality in nutrition education. So that should be a very interesting topic. And then the Fall Journal Club starts on September 12th. We're going to look at health behaviors across the lifespan. The Monday webinars will be at noon. So thank you for joining us today. We look forward to seeing you on the next webinar.